This is tape number one. Mr. Parviz Raji in his house in London on the 9th of April 1986. We are going to start with a short biography of Mr. Raji's about his background, his family, education, up to the point where he enters public life, and then we go from there with the actual interview. Okay, Mr. Raji, it's up to you now. Let's go from the beginning, your childhood, your education, the whole thing.
Right. I was born in Tehran in 1936, the younger of two sons, to a father who was a French trained orthopedic surgeon. And yet, despite my father's French background and education, he had early on in his life decided that his sons should have, in inverted commas, an Anglo-Saxon education. In 1950, when I was 12 and my brother 13, I was 13 and my brother 14, we were sent to the States, where we enrolled at a rather smart East Coast private school in Pottstown, Pennsylvania, by the name of the Hill School, and I understand the school is still there and functioning very properly. But we only stayed there for a year because, as you will remember, in 1951 there was the Anglo-Iranian oil crisis. Oil was, the petroleum industry in Iran was nationalized under Dr. Mossadegh, and as a consequence, there was an interruption to the flow of oil, and foreign exchange became scarce and very expensive. And under those circumstances, my father could no longer afford to keep us in America. And we were brought over to England in 1951. For a while, his financial difficulties persisted. We would spend 3 or 4 months, particularly of the summer months, in Iran to ease the burden on him, and then come to England and go to various schools. And this rather uncertain situation persisted until 1953, when the oil dispute was settled, and the consortium began to operate the Iranian oil fields, and after a while the flow of foreign exchange into the treasury resumed, and this eased the situation all around. So we stayed on in England. My brother eventually went to Edinburgh in 1956 to study medicine, and I gained admission to Trinity Hall, Cambridge, where I read for a degree in economics. In 1959, on the completion of my tri-pass, I returned to Tehran, full of enthusiasm to apply my newly acquired skills, such as they were. A viewing of the Iranian seen made it quite clear to me that the oil industry, which was really the prime mover of the economy in Iran, was the source of all wealth and therefore all power. And I made up my mind that I wanted to join the oil industry, which I did, I think in 1960. In a country which is suffering a shortage of trained minds, as Iran then was, I expect still is, it wasn't particularly difficult to work one's way up the bureaucratic ladder. It was when I joined the NIOC, in fact, that I first met Amir Abbas Oveda, who was to play a dominant role in my subsequent life. Amir Abbas Oveda was a career diplomat who was then in charge of administration at the oil company. He himself had been brought on into the oil company by the then chairman of NIOC, who was someone called Abdullah Entezam. Abdullah Entezam, it will be recalled, played a crucial but unsuccessful role many years later in 79 during the revolution. But at that time, he was in charge of the NIOC as a kind of elder statesman diplomat. He himself was a career diplomat, and he'd served abroad, I think, in Germany after the war. And he had also at some stage served as foreign minister, I believe, and also deputy prime minister. And it was on account of his background in the public domain that he was entrusted with what was then the country's leading industry. But Entezam was an elderly man, even in the 1960s. I think he was in his 70s then, wasn't he?
No, he was in his 60s. Yes, he was.
60s, was he?
Yes, yes.
But I think he was afflicted with ill health. He had, I think he'd had a history of respiratory ailments. Anyway, he was, he kept very elegant hours, I remember. He would turn up at NIOC by Persian standards rather late in the morning, around about 9:30, 10 o'clock, make une acte de présence, and disappear around about 1 o'clock and not turn up in the afternoon. And because of his work style, he had found it necessary to delegate a great deal of his authority to his subordinates. And of course, his most trusted subordinate was Amir Abbas Oveda, who had served under him, I think, on one or two assignments abroad, certainly in Germany, I think, I seem to remember, in Stuttgart after the war. Anyway, again, on account of a lack of trained minds, if you like, or a shortage of trained minds, it was only a matter of time before I found myself into Oveda's office and was appointed by him to act as his private secretary. Oveda, of whom I shall speak later, was a very demanding boss, but it was also a very rewarding association working with him. He was open to ideas, he was incapable of pulling rank, which I found a rare and most welcome quality amongst Persian officialdom. And of course, he was totally trusted by Entezam, much to the annoyance and envy of the other directors. A word also about Antizam. He was a giant of a man in terms of his reputation. He was of unquestioned probity in his approach to public life. He had a towering reputation for honesty, and he had he belonged to the Sufi tradition in the Persian culture, which he not only preached but also practiced. And he had a complete disregard for the trappings of wealth and power. I stayed on at the NIOC for about 3 years, and even though I can perhaps consider my stay there as a success, I was beginning to become slightly disenchanted with my work at NIOC, primarily because it emerged that the road up the ladder in NIOC was limited for someone who had not had a training either on the technical or on the legal side of the oil industry. And while it was perfectly true that Antizam himself was a political appointment, it also dawned on me that there were shortcuts to the higher up positions, if you like, of the oil company, through channels other than the NIOC itself. So after a while, and after consultations with Hoveda, I decided to join the Iranian Foreign Ministry. This required the taking of an entrance examination and an interview, all of which posed no serious problems. And in 1963, I entered the foreign minister. The foreign minister then was someone called Abbas Aram, who subsequently served as Iran's ambassador in London. And 3 or 4 months after my joining the Foreign Office, I found myself given the rather prestigious job of acting as Mr. Aram's private secretary or personal assistant. Aram was a difficult man to work for. He received his education in India, and perhaps this explains about my sounding disrespectful, why he was a very reliable number two, but not a very good number one. He could never initiate any policy. He, I think, lacked vision, imagination, initiative, but he could be relied upon to carry out whatever decisions had been taken with great diligence and care. He was pernickety as far as words were concerned. He was always changing his speeches, and I remember that it was sheer agony working on one of his longest speeches, because, for instance, at the United Nations, because he was really, in a sense, capable of decision, and it was only the time factor that ultimately saved one from this indecisiveness on his part. The moment arrived when he had to go and stand behind the podium and deliver his speech, and once he'd done that, of course, the whole thing was over. He was not an unkind man, and I had great respect for his knowledge of the English language. He was, in fact, a wordsmith. He actually enjoyed stringing words together and producing what he thought were witticisms, etc., etc. But he did stay on, I think, for 7 years as foreign minister, and I would really be surprised if even once during these years he would have raised a matter which he thought might even mildly irritate the Shah or put him in bad temper. His routine of work was that the telegrams, the dispatches came in, the telexes came in from our various embassies across the world during the evening and early morning. These would be decoded and typed out by a pool of confidential secretaries. Then the foreign secretary would exercise his judgment as to which of these were worthy of consideration by the Shah, and he would then, round about noon each day, make his daily pilgrimage from the foreign ministry to the Shah's palace in Sadabad, in Shamran, submit the cables for His Majesty's perusal, and obtain the Shah's comments or instructions, and then drive back down to Tehran, and in the afternoon he would transmit these instructions to the various ambassadors and consuls or whatever. By a curious coincidence, both Intizam and Hoveyda also left the NIOC shortly after I did. You'll remember? In 1962, Kennedy had been elected to the presidency of America, and if you remember, during a visit to Vienna, I believe, he holds that famous kitchen debate. Kitchen because they were surrounded by American modern gadgetry when the debate took place. He held that debate with Khrushchev, where Khrushchev boasts that the capitalistic world will the communistic world will triumph over capitalism, and he castigates Kennedy for supporting such reactionary regimes as that of the Shah of Iran, and says that Iran is a rotten apple which will soon fall into the lap of communism. This, of course, annoyed Kennedy intensely, and during one of the Shah's annual trips to Washington, when he meets Kennedy, I have it on reliable sources that Kennedy actually puts his feet on the table and says to the Shah, "What are you going to do about the feudal image of your country?" Of course, as is well known, led to what subsequently became known as the revolution of the Shah and the people. The Shah came back to Iran. There had been voices within Iran, particularly on the left. The name of Afsanjani comes to my mind.
What's his first name?
Hassan Afsanjani, I think he was. Who had for a very long time been clamoring for some kind of agrarian reform in Iran. The traditional classical situation where you had a number of land lords on vast tracts of the country, most of them absentee landlords, where the peasants slaved away on the farm. The landlord took half and distributed the rest to all and sundry. Anyway, the Shah came back to Iran and he instituted his really quite fundamental reform measures, called it the White Revolution to begin with, when the white was smeared with a great deal of blood in later years. It became the revolution of the Shah and the people. But white in the sense that it was bloodless and it was being instituted from the top and it was enlightened. Amongst the measures that he introduced, and he submitted all this to a national referendum, was in fact the land reform. And there was a literacy corps. My memory serves me ill now, but it's been so many years. But I think there was a literacy corps, there was a profit-sharing scheme for factory workers, and also, and I think this came as an afterthought, also legal rights for women. I don't want to dwell at length on this. I mention this because the upshot of the institution of all these measures was a reaction amongst the clergy. Foremost amongst the people who opposed these measures, which they held to be in contradiction to the Sharia, the religious law, was Khomeini. And this is, we are not talking about 1963. I remember, I don't really know the exact date in the Christian calendar, but in the Persian calendar it is the 15th of Khordad. And I remember that I was driving to the foreign ministry from Shamran, and I could see smoke rising from the public library, which the mob had burnt in downtown Tehran. There was the sound of sporadic machine gun fire, and the disturbances were effectively put an end to. Entezam, who had a weekly audience with the Shah, and who had been, in a sense, rather appalled at the ferocity with which these disturbances had been dealt with, and who was, of course, you will remember, very much in the Sufistic tradition of things, moderation in all things, braces himself on one of his weekly audiences with the Shah, and cautions that His Majesty should proceed with moderation in the pursuit of his worthy objectives. And I don't really know whether Entezam was privy to the kind of pressure that was being exercised on the Shah by the Americans, but the Shah didn't have very much room to maneuver. He'd been told to do something about the feudalistic image of his country, and he was going to undertake the measures that that would have changed that image. So in a kind of, the Shah didn't like what Entezam had said, but Entezam, of course, was a man of deep conviction and not one who would give in easily, particularly as he was, and I think I said this earlier, he really had no attachment to worldly power or riches. So during one official ceremony, I forget which now, on a grand occasion at the Gulistan Palace, Entezam as the most senior civil servant had traditionally the role of reading the message for felicitations on a particular occasion to the Shah, to which the Shah would reply in a couple of sentences or so. On this particular occasion, Entezam has the temerity to say publicly to the Shah that I wish Your Majesty well in the pursuit of the objectives, the high ideals that you set yourself, and it's his bottom line that really annoys HIM immensely. Entezam says, I hope you will continue to implement your reform measures with moderation. It's the with moderation that hits a raw nerve. And Entezam was known to smoke a few cigarettes and I think occasionally have a few drinks. And the Shah turns around and in front of all the assembled personages says that moderation is a good thing in drinking and smoking, but not in the pursuit of worthy ideals, and turns on his heel and disappears.
You certainly have the art of repartee.
Anyway, this was the last time that Entezam saw the Shah for a very long time. He left the NIAC chairmanship very shortly after that, and of course with Entezam's departure, Obeida went too. Again, as a part of the new image which the Shah was trying to build for himself and for Iran, he had encouraged the educated young technocrats to come together and form some kind of political party. One of the people who'd read the signs right and had considerable talent in attracting people to himself and an organizing ability was someone called Hassan Ali Mansour, whom you will remember. He had initially formed the Progressive Center, and the Progressive Center, after a while, became the Iran and Noveen, or the New Iran Political Party. And they, with tacit royal approval, participated in the parliamentary elections, I think of 63, if I'm not mistaken. My date may be suspect, but I think it's 63. And they won a sizable majority. Mansour had been a lifelong friend of Hoveda, and I think both of them had served at some stage under Entezam. And the Shah appointed Mansour as Prime Minister. This was 3 months after, 3 or 4 months after Hoveda had left the oil company. And in Mansour's newly formed cabinet, Hoveda was given the highly important post or Minister of Finance. So in a sense, if you like, technically he was now the boss of the oil company, because all the oil revenue would eventually go into the coffers of the finance minister. I had only just gone to the foreign ministry, and not very long after Hoveyda, I beg your pardon, I was retracted on that. Mansour's premiership lasted 10 or 11 months. I think I'm right in saying that when the Shah had been to Washington to talk with Kennedy, while Kennedy had expressed his dislike of the feudalistic image of the Shah's Iran, the Shah had also expressed his wish for modernizing the Iranian armed forces. After all, that was his power base. And I think reluctantly, Kennedy had agreed to send a then Colonel Haig to have a look at the